this brand new session. I'm glad to have a bit of breeze coming through the window. It might be a little quick. I don't know what you should do if I nod off, but I'm glad you guys have time just to deal with me. This morning we thought about God's life, God the spring of living water, and we move between John 4 and Jeremiah 17. For this talk, I'm just going to stick with one book. So I'm going to send you guys back into John's Gospel in your discussion groups and give you a bit of work to do. So just one book in this talk, maybe the small print, I should confess at the front, is that we're going to cover the whole thing. The whole book, at least in an overview, before we slow down to focus on the crisis and climax at the end of the book, Exodus 32 to 34. I chose Exodus, partly because it's a great book, and if you haven't read it, you should, and if you have read it, you should read it again. It's a book with a unique and powerful vision of God's character, a vision of God that really shapes everything he says about himself in the rest of the Bible. And the Exodus vision boils down to four words. If I had to say what Exodus is about, God reveals his name. It's a great plot summary for the book of Exodus. God reveals his name. Now, the overview of Exodus that I'd like to give you this morning is one that I'm going to call a tale of two journeys. When my kids do the HSC journeys, a big thing. Is that right? Yeah. Did you hate it? Or loved it? It was all right. Anyway, in Exodus, it's like there's the external journey, the visible journey, if you like, and then there's the internal or invisible journey. And so let's start with the external journey, which is a story of rescue. It's a classic rescue or redemption story. So it begins at the beginning. If you've got a Bible open, I'm going to pick it up at chapter 2, verse 23. It's in Egypt, we have an enslaved people who cry out for help. And I think they're actually crying out to a God they do not know. It's just some little hints there. So 123, during that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. And their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So there's the crisis at the beginning of the novel that sets the story of redemption underway. And in the following chapters, these poor slaves are miraculously rescued through all those plagues and the Red Sea, and they're taken on a journey to a mountain where they meet God. In fact, chapter 3, verse 9, when God speaks to Moses, see, he says, "The cry of the Israelites has reached me. I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" God said, "I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you draw the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain." So there's the destination of the journey, the mountain. And when they arrive at the mountain, God makes himself present in their midst by speaking. And by speaking, he forms a bond, a unique relational bond with this one people, the covenant. And in that covenant, he commits himself exclusively to Israel. They commit themselves exclusively to him, like a marriage. And on this mountain, after he's bound the people to himself with a covenant, God gives Moses the plans for a mobile mountain. We call it a tabernacle. And that begins in Exodus 24. So Exodus 24, I could have read Exodus 20, where God speaks the Ten Commandments. We'll come back to that in a minute. Exodus 24, verse 15, when Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. For 6 days the cloud covered the mountain, and on the seventh day the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud. To the Israelites, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on top of a mountain. Then Moses entered the cloud as he went up on the mountain, and he stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So there's Moses on the top of the mountain in the cloud of God's glory. What's happening up there? What's happening up there is he's getting the plans for this tabernacle. And the idea of the tabernacle is like you meet God at Mount Sinai, but you can't stay at Mount Sinai forever. You go to the land, and so the tabernacle is like a little portable Mount Sinai. And in fact, if you get to the end of the book, chapter 40, verse 34, pretty quick overview, eh? The tabernacle is complete, and it says, then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of the meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And all the travels of the Israelites, whatever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they'd set out. But if the cloud did not lift, they did not set out until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the Israelites during all their travels. See what I mean about like a mobile mountain? It's like God's glorious presence goes with them. The presence they met on the mountain as they travel towards the land. So there's the book of Exodus as a journey of rescue. Right? People cry out to a God they do not know. He rescues them, brings them to himself, makes a unique bond with them, and then makes a way to be able to travel their life's journey in their midst. Well, as in any great journey story, the visible journey is always a vehicle for something a bit deeper, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Check with my HSE experts out here. And in this case, it's like a journey of discovery or revelation, if you like. And so, I want to go back to chapter 3, verse 13, and look at this internal journey, the journey of discovery that the book of Exodus is actually all about. It begins in exactly the same place as the external journey in Egypt when an enslaved people cry out for help to a God they do not know. And when Moses brings them God's rescue plan, they want to know this God's name. Verse 13, Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what's his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you're to say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. A famously cryptic reply. I am, in Hebrew it sounds like God's name, Yahweh. Right, which is the name that's printed in our Bibles as capital L-O-R-D, or capitals. Now, that's still a fairly cryptic name, to be honest. But that's okay, because Israel's whole journey is designed to reveal to them more and more of the meaning of that name. Right? Remember my four-word summary, God reveals his name. Well, Yahweh, what does that mean? And there's the beginning of the journey of discovery. Are we good so far? Nobody asleep yet? That's good, because there's a little way to go. Right, the journey of this talk, we're not nearly there. So what I've been saying is everything God does for Israel in the book of Exodus shows them more about what his name means. That is, who he is, his character. And as they come to understand the meaning of his name, that goes along with their experience of him in their lives. So by the time they've crossed the Red Sea and been delivered from the Egyptians, they sing this song of praise in Exodus 15 that shows you how much bigger their God has just become. Because they've learned that his name has another meaning. Chapter 15, verse 2. The Lord, right, all capitals, Yahweh, is my strength and my song. He's become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is our warrior. The Lord is his name. They've learned that the name Yahweh means Savior. It means strength. It means warrior. Their God has just got bigger. But it's when they reach the mountain that they really begin to learn who their God is. Right? There's something utterly unique about the true God compared to any other God that they ever knew. The Lord is not a part of this creation. He's creator of everything. He's outside and above the universe. He is not a made thing. And when we are stupid enough to worship the creation rather than our creator, everything, as we know, goes terribly wrong. And the second commandment in Exodus 20 captures this truth by adding a new dimension to God's character. And it's a very honest, unexpected one. It's jealousy. Chapter 20, verse 4, the second commandment. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. Why? Because I, the Lord, capital L-O-R-D, your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. I want to come back and think about this jealousy a little bit right at the end of our talk journey. But as it's not human jealousy for a start. Right? This is an expression of God's determination to be God. Right? To rule the world as only he can do it. An infinite wisdom and power and goodness. The moment God is displaced by the worship of one of his creatures, well, that's terrible. God is never going to let that happen. And it's not just for the sake of his glory. It's for everything's well-being. God is jealous. So far so good, right? Israel's journey is going pretty well. They've reached the mountain, the goal of their journey. They're discovering what God's name means. But as we arrive at the terrible tragedy of the golden calf, sort of throws all of this knowledge of God they had up for grabs. Because there's this new, unexpected, urgent question about the character of God, which is where I want to spend most of our time, and that is, can there be room in God's nature for mercy? How does that even work? So, without further ado, let us turn to Exodus 32. And slow down. Now, at this stage, Moses is spending his 40 days up on the mountain in a cloud, right? The people down below, well, we'll see. We get three scenes that sort of alternate between earth, meaning the camp where the people are, and heaven, meaning the mountain where Moses goes to meet God. Now, the first scene, we see Israel's terrible rebellion play out. Verse 1. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. That's for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt. We don't know what's happened to him." If you look what they say in that verse, I don't think they're trying to replace the Lord himself. It's more like they're trying to replace the missing Moses, isn't it? You know, what they want is gods who can do Moses' job of bringing them up from Egypt. Now, the Egypt they grew up in was a place where many, many gods were worshipped. Each god had a little area of responsibility. And if you look down at verse 4, I think you'll see that's what they think they've done. They've created an object that can, like, harness the presence, the power of an Egypt rescue god or two. Take it from verse 2. Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they had in him and made it into an idol, cast in the shape of a calf, fashioned with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." So there's still a connection with the God Yahweh. I don't think if you ask them, they would have said, "Oh yeah, we've rejected the Lord as our God." It's like, we're just doing some subcontracting. Yeah? Just bringing in some extra gods to help. And Aaron gets this. In verse 5, he tries to keep things on track by announcing a feast to the Lord. Right? When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord. So in their minds, they're still worshipping the Lord, but they're doing it in their own way to try and make up for Moses' absence as the person who sort of stood between them and the Lord and made it all happen. Maybe this calf can do it instead. Pretty hard to sort out what Aaron's motives are here. You know, was he an enthusiastic participant? Did he feel threatened or afraid by the people's, they're going to get violent about this? We're not told. But in verse 4, we get Aaron's work spelled out in quite some detail. There's no getting away from his real involvement in this. Even though it's not Aaron, but it's the people who identify the calf as representing other gods of the Lord. It's like Aaron saying, they're saying, the gods brought us out of Egypt. And Aaron's saying, let's worship the Lord. You know, there's a little bit of a tension between them. But Aaron, if he's trying to retrieve a bad situation, he's got no hope. Right? Verse 6 begins by describing regular sacrifices, but it only gets worse. Right? The next day the people rose early, sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterwards, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. They may have started doing regular sacrifices, but they're soon getting drunk and debauched and who knows. It's a tragic scene. It's like a preview of Jesus in Gethsemane. You know, could you not watch with me 40 days? Moses might have said. Sure, it's a long time, but remember what you experienced. You went through the slavery, you went through the plagues, you went through the Red Sea, you had the terror of God speaking from the mountain. Who even is God to you after all that you've gone through together? He seems to be God the distant. You know, God the irrelevant, this God of empty words. Sure, I guess he saved us, but this is my life now. You know, God who? The Psalm 106, I think it says, they exchanged their glory for an image of a bull which eats grass. They forgot the God who saved them. Forgetfulness. But let's move on. Scene 2. We go up to heaven. This is God's response. Verse 7. Listen to how God says this. There's a bit of a distancing going on in God's speech. The Lord said to Moses, go down because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. And then he tells Moses what's been going on far out of his sight at the bottom of the mountain. Right? They've been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast for the shape of a calf. They bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. There's an interesting little technique in Hebrew narrative where you always have two characters sort of on the stage at the same time exchanging dialogue. But sometimes in order to say that if I'm talking to this person and they just stand there not saying anything, you'll have me introduced for a fresh speech, which is what you have in verse 9. Right? So God speaks to Moses in verse 7. He finishes his speech. And then verse 9, I have seen these people, the Lord said to Moses. The hint there is like Moses just stood there. He's got nothing to say. You know, awkward silence. Basically he's announcing a verdict in verse 9. I've seen these people, they're stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation. This idol worship was not a slip-up. Right? This reveals actually what these people are deep within themselves and what they always will be. Right? They are broken. There can only be one right response, that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. But Moses, gotta love Moses, is not going to accept this without putting up a fight. Can you imagine what it would have been like? You know, alone on a mountain surrounded by darkness and lightning, addressed by this terrifying voice, like when the people heard it, they thought they were going to die. In the conscious presence of this infinite power and wisdom and goodness, and Moses answers back. You know? I don't think we're supposed to identify with Moses, by the way, and thank goodness. You know, he was specially called and strengthened by God to actually act in this role as a mediator for the people. So his role as prophet. And by the time we reach chapter 34, Moses is actually going to have stood up in front of God and pleaded for the people three more times. When Moses dies, the Bible actually recognizes that nobody ever stood in those shoes of Moses again until Jesus. He's a great man. What does he say? Verse 11. Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. Actually, it's probably a more accurate translation, sorry, NIV, to say that Moses sought to weaken God's resolve. You know, to sort of soften God up. Seeking the favor, it does mean that, right? I don't want to criticize the NIV, it's exactly right. But it's a troubling idea, isn't it? Surely God doesn't waver or weaken. I just want to pause here and see what's going on. And I think to do that, we've got to go back to verse 10 for a second look, if that's okay. Let me tell you what God did not say. He didn't say, "I hereby declare that I will destroy them and make you a great nation." Do you see that? See what he did say? He said, "Leave me alone so that my anger might burn." Do you see that? I don't know if you feel a difference between those. I reckon that it's like God is carefully making a space for Moses to intercede. Now, leave me alone. Don't persuade me. And he's also testing Moses. All Moses has to do is say nothing again. And then justice will roll down and they'll die as they so richly deserve. And you, Moses, being raised to new heights of greatness. But thankfully, Moses was already great. Now, this great servant of God valued God's name above his own name. And so he spoke words to appease, to soften, to move God from doing one good thing to doing a different good thing. And what's driving him is a concern for the name of God, the character of God. See what Moses says. "Lord, why should your anger burn against your people whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought them out, to kill them on the mountain and to wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people." Right, the Egyptians will think you acted out of evil. Your name, your character is going to be devalued by this. And then look at verse 13. "Remember your servants Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars of the sky, and I will give your descendants of all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever." So he's saying you made a promise by yourself, by your name. "So then, Lord, please, instead of acting out of your commitment to justice, please consider acting from your commitment to your ancient promise." I don't know if this relationship between Moses and the Lord is making sense to you or not. I think what I'm trying to get across is this is not Moses sort of forcing or tricking God into changing his mind. But there's a sort of a little beautiful tango going on here, a little dance. You know, first, God comes up to Moses with something in his hand. He's got this treaty just signed only 40 days ago by Israel. The ink still wet on the stone, but it's violated so badly that this treaty has become their death warrant. And then it's Moses' turn. And he comes and he sees that God's left a little space for him to reach past the treaty to the promise behind him. And Moses reaches for the promise because he thinks that just simply executing the covenant penalties doesn't do proper justice to the character of God. It's like God is gently nudging Moses towards a new possibility for what his name might mean. So, who is the Lord to Moses? He is God the Redeemer, the righteous, the loving, the relational, the faithful, the God who raises up the humble, the God who draws near to us in glory and gentleness, who loves good and hates evil. And perhaps he could be a God of mercy as well. Well, that brings us to our last scene from this section of Exodus, back to earth, verse 15. So Moses comes back down to earth, and the narrator describes the stone tablets with this elaborate detail. But these tablets are uniquely precious. Think about it. It's like they are the voice of the living God frozen on stone. And from now on, this will be the way by which God makes himself present in their midst. There's a really interesting detail, just to go off on a brief tangent while I think of it. In Exodus 25, when God gives them instructions for building the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant, the Atonement Covenant, and he says, the cherubim are to have their wings spread upwards, overshadowing the cover with them. The cherubim are to face each other. Right? These are the carved cherubim on top of the box that has the covenant law in it. Remember that? It says, place the cover on top of the ark. Put in the ark the tablets of the covenant law that I will give you. There, listen to how precise this is, above the cover, between the two cherubim that are over the ark of the covenant law, I will meet with you and give you all my commands for the Israelites. It's a really interesting thing. Here it is, the Ark of the Covenant, a box that contains the two tablets of the law. Over the box are the two cherubim. I don't have enough hands to do it like this. And God is going to meet with them right here. Now, if you went into a temple anywhere in the ancient world, into its equivalent of the Holy of Holies, what would you have seen in that empty space? You would have seen an idol, right? An image. And what God is showing Israel is that there is going to be an empty space where I will meet you with you. How is he going to meet with them in that empty space? Well, what's in the ark? The written words of God. And through God's written law, he is going to make himself present with more reality and immediacy than any idol. My daughter told me something yesterday, actually, that I didn't know. She's studying Mesopotamian history and studying Sumerian. Somebody's got it, right? Anyway, she told me that Sumerian is a language that doesn't have gender, male and female, in its grammar. But I'm so off the track, but I'll get that there. But it has and something they call animity. In other words, it's got a marker in its speech for whether something is alive or dead. But it doesn't have male and female. Really interesting. And so things that are marked as alive, as dead, are objects, but also animals. Right? They're not considered to be alive. Things that do get the marker of animity, I think that's what she said it was called, are humans, gods, and idols. Really interesting, isn't it? But there's no idol in the tabernacle. God makes himself present in living power through his word. Okay, back on track. Chapter 32, verse 15. Maybe it's the after lunch that drives me to just thinking of stuff and saying it. Anyway. Here are these tablets. And as they get lower, Joshua, he's like Moses' PA, you know, he's never too far away, he hears noises which sound to him like a battle. So verse 15, Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "There's the sound of war in the camp." Moses replied, "It's not the sound of victory. It's not the sound of defeat. It is the sound of singing that I hear." Moses knew better because God already told him, right? It's just singing. Not a good sign. But Moses is, I think, a bit reluctant to think of worse of Israel than he must. So just for the moment, he's going to reserve judgment and say no more. Eventually, they get low enough that they catch sight of the camp for the first time. And Moses, just remember what he's been like, soft-hearted, interceding, reaching past the law for the promise, reluctant to assume the worst. Suddenly, he gets overwhelmed by the exact same anger that God felt. Right, back in verse 9, God said, "I have seen." And look what happens in verse 19. When Moses approached the camp, he saw the calf and the dancing. The phrase that God said in verse 10, "Leave me alone so my anger might burn," what does it say in verse 19? "And his anger burned. And he threw the tablets out of his hand, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain." What's happened to Moses' soft heart? Yeah? There's no turning from anger here, no, none of this remembering the promise stuff. Instead, he throws these precious tablets down, smashes them at the foot of the mountain. Those tablets were the way by which God was coming down the mountain with Moses to dwell among his people. But how can God dwell among a people like that? You know, people have chosen to have other gods beside them. These are people who, they've made their choice, they've got to live with it. You know, worship of material things, gratification of their desires of their body. In the language of Jeremiah, they've dug their own cracked cisterns and filled them with their own water. They're dead. So Moses is now seeing them with God's eyes and venting his godly anger on the people in verse 20 and then on Aaron. He took the calf the people had made and burned it in the fire. Then he ground it to powder, scattered it on the water and made Israelites drink it. He said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin?" "Do not be angry, my Lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who go before us.' As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him." So I told them, "Whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off." And they gave me the gold and I threw it into the fire. And out came this calf. Aaron's efforts to escape blame, I think, are intended to make us laugh. They sort of descend to the comical. But he's a very small part of this tragedy. And Moses looks past Aaron to look at the real tragedy, right? Aaron didn't make them desert God. He just allowed them to run wild. And the end result is that God's name is brought into disrepute among the nations. Verse 25, Moses saw that the people were running wild and that Aaron had let them get out of control and so become a laughing stock to their enemies. So he stood at the entrance to the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And all the Levites rallied to him. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man struck a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor." The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. Then Moses said, "You've been set apart to the Lord today, for you were against your own sons and brothers. He's blessed you this day." It's a terrible punishment. But as always in the Bible, the punishment matches the crime. What they've done is they've torn apart the family of God. God has entered into a marriage-style, unique relationship of faithfulness and created a family out of these people. They have destroyed all of that, and they receive judgment in kind. Verse 27, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says." Right? This tragic killing of brother by brother, friend by friend, this isn't Moses' will, this is God's will. What do we make of this apparent decision to be wrathful after all? Is this like God has changed his mind back again? You know, is he like relenting about relenting? Is his name justice instead of mercy after all? Well, not exactly. Verse 28, like 3,000 is a lot of people, but it's only a small fraction of the total. And in verse 29, the people who carried out justice do it as God's agents of blessing. It's weird that he uses language of blessing, but I think what it means is that God has carried out a limited judgment so that he can change the outcome of Israel's wild behavior. And if we read on further, which I won't do now because it's the dreaded post-lunch period, can't talk too long, you see that actually the Israelites respond to this judgment by mourning their sin, by turning back to God and worship. God shows mercy by not wiping them out. He shows more mercy through a terrible act of justice. It's not a choice with God, justice or mercy. It's always both. And yet, we're almost at the end of our journey, but I still don't feel that we've got to the bottom of the question of God's mercy. So let me put it this way. I don't know if this is the most helpful way, but let's give it a go. So we're thinking about the character of God this weekend, right? So is God's justice the attribute that lies at the very heart of his character, and that justice is then like tempered by mercy? Or is it the other way around? Is mercy the thing at the very heart of his character, which is then tempered by justice? Or is it more like a yin and a yang thing, a sort of constant conversation between the two? How do we think about God's mercy in relationship to the rest of his character? And that brings us to the climax of our journey, Exodus 34. All right, need to stand up, turn around, make a joke. Yeah, come on, stand up. We're getting tough. This is the time for a craft activity, or maybe for a little game running about the room. Or maybe you could build Mount Sinai, you know? Or a tabernacle, that would be even more fun. All right. Take a seat if you feel like. Remain standing as you wish. We're getting close to the end of this little journey. Do you remember where we began? Exodus has taken us on a journey that where we discover what it means that God calls himself Yahweh. I am the Lord. Right? At the first, all was going well. We learned that Yahweh means redeemer, it means savior, it means warrior. It means promise keeper, covenant maker, righteous judge. But then we get this golden calf, which is just a massive disruption to everything. And it threatens the whole covenant relationship as soon as it comes into existence. And then it seems like, okay, God would really like to bless you, but justice demands to be served. Right? Remember the second commandment? God must vigorously punish sin, even though he's still going to bless those who obey him. But these little scenes of up in heaven, down on earth, up in heaven, they're showing us that there's actually something more to God's character than that. There's an aspect of God that you don't really see until you get blatant rebellion and evil. And then you see what God is like. You know, God is never going to not reject evil, absolutely. But he's always going to do what it takes to keep that promise that lies behind the law, God's blessed. And so now in the bits that we've read, he's using Moses, the mediator, to plead for the people. Moses is God's instrument of punishment, and he's also God's instrument of mercy. But then this is all like preparation for the final scene, where God speaks his name one more time. And this time it's different because God's speaking his name in the aftermath of that rebellion. And this time, when he speaks his name, we're going all the way in to God's character, to his being. Those are the verses that Gordon read as he prayed. And I'm going to come to them now. It's just 34, verse 6. He passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, a compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children of their children for the sin of the parents to a third and fourth generation. So much to say about this, and I'll just say maybe four brief things. First one is that the background for this is when Moses pleads for God, for the people in chapter 33. And in verse 17, in fact, verse 15, Moses says to God, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you're pleased with me and your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? See what Moses is saying. You've called us out of Egypt, out of the nations, to be your, what does it say in Exodus 19? Your royal priesthood, your treasured possession, and to show the world what God is like. Well, if we go through, if we're not stamped by your character, what's even the point of us? And the Lord said to Moses, verse 17, I'll do the very thing you've asked, because I'm pleased with you and I know you by name. Then Moses said, now show me your glory. And the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I'll proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I'll have mercy on him, I'll have mercy, and I'll have compassion on him, I'll have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Now, really interesting, verse 18, what does Moses ask God to show him? Exodus 33:18. What does Moses ask God to show him?
His glory.
His glory. Well done. You get an awake mark. What does God say he will show him in verse 19? His goodness and then his name. It's not that God is giving Moses something he didn't ask for. What is God's glory? God's glory is who he is. God's glory is his goodness, and God's glory is his name. You can say it the other way around. God's name is who he is. God's name is his glory. And that's what God does, right? There's a place where you may stand on the rock. When my glory passes, I'll put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I've passed by. Then I'll remove my hand and you'll see my back, but my face must not be seen. So that's what's the background to Exodus 34, 6 and 7, right? The Lord comes down in the cloud, stands there with him and proclaims his name, the Lord. So this is the, how far has Moses come? Since the beginning of the book, where he said, who should I say that you are? God says, tell them that I am. Ascending. Moses is like, okay, whatever. Like, what even is that? And now, what have they been through? They've been through the Red Sea. They've been through the most awful rebellion of people who've been saved and loved and chosen by God and turned their backs on him. And God says, this is who I am. Compassionate, gracious, slow to anger. Now, that's my first comment about these verses, is that what God is doing when he proclaims his name is proclaiming his glory, his goodness. Second comment, to get what's going on here, it's really helpful to compare these verses with the second commandment against idolatry, because there's a close echo. So this is how we're going to do it. This is your little exercise, right? I want you to look at Exodus 34, verse 6. You got it? And while you've got Exodus 34, 6, I am going to read Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, which is the commandment against idolatry. And this is what I want you to spot. I want you to spot how the verses are the same, but more importantly, how they're different. You ready? So, you shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. Here it comes. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. All right. What are the differences?
Punishing goes first.
Yes, there's a reversal, isn't it? Punishing first, followed by love. Notice any other? There's one other that I noticed, but I have prepared this, right? So I don't get any points for noticing the other one. Yes, thank you. I've now left Exodus 20 behind. Yes, he talks about being a jealous God, which is a difference on the surface, but as we come back to Exodus 32, we're going to see that it's there in Exodus 34 as well. But keep going. Oh, now I'm in Genesis 20. No wonder I can't find it. Exodus 20. Let me just read you that bit again. I'm a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. There's something that is missing.
Love to 1,000 generations. It's now love to thousands of people.
Yes, and thousands of generations of those who love me. It says in Exodus 20. And in Exodus 20, it says the sins of the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. So the bits that I think, if you look at Exodus 34 again, the Lord compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands. Not only does God's love, which was second in the commandment, go first, but it's much expanded. Right? God has brought his mercy to the top of the list. But then maintaining love to thousands, not thousands of those who love me back. Such an interesting difference. Forgiving wickedness and rebellion and sin, yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third, fourth generation. Again, those who hate me is left out. Those who love me, the reciprocal nature of I will repay you. I will reward you. God's love becomes unconditional. So God's mercy is put at the top and the condition is removed. Really interesting difference. Right? God's mercy is mentioned first, not last, and it's offered, no longer offered, only to people who remain obedient. This is mercy without condition, without favoritism, without consideration of merit or convenience to himself. This is not God showing mercy because of who we are. This is not even God showing mercy because he made a promise to save us. Or even God showing mercy because he feels sorry for us. This is God showing mercy because that is who he is. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. And that is my profound truth about God for this afternoon. I want to say it again. Right? How can we have any hope that God is going to stay our God in the face of how bad we are? How we fail daily to please him? Right? Even after knowing who he is, what he's done on the cross, having received the benefits of his saving work, we still fail to respond to him? Right? Our hope that even despite who we are, God is going to be for us, that hope is ultimately not grounded in what God has promised. It's grounded in who he is. And my third point, I think, is that God's mercy isn't just an interesting, fun fact about him, but God's mercy actually lies at the very core of his being. You know, we humans, we're impressed by other things, by scale and bigness and power and transcendence. But there's a sense in which mercy is more godlike than power. Now, it's wrong, of course, to set these things over against each other, right? God's mercy, in fact, is nothing less than his power at work. But God's mercy is the core of who he is. Final point. God's mercy does not erase his jealousy. A bit later in Exodus 34, verse 14, he says, "Do not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God." Very uncomfortable idea, isn't it? God's jealousy. Feels, I don't know, a bit like God's being almost petty and self-obsessed. What does he need to be jealous for? It's interesting, what God is mainly jealous about, he's jealous for his own glory. And again, that sounds uncomfortable. You know, is there an insecurity going on there? But let's think about this for 1 minute. What we've just talked about, what God's glory means, it's another way of saying his character, right? And he's called Israel to be his people for what reason? So they can manifest his character to the world, right? Be conduits for the living water that the rest of the world needs to stay alive. The whole creation, in fact, is a reflection of God's glory and his character. The heavens declare the glory of God. Humans are made in his glorious image. When you look at the world and see God's character in it, then you're looking at a happy world, a flourishing world. So when God's jealous for his glory, he's being jealous for us as well. He's being jealous for the beautiful world that he made that reflects who he is. You can't separate them. I know of a woman, I don't know her personally, friend of a friend, whose husband left her for another woman. And in the midst of her shock, her grief, her deep anger and hurt, she felt this deep jealousy rising up. You know, after what her husband did, she had every right in the eyes of God to divorce him. But she felt jealous. You know, she determined, this other woman is not going to take my husband away. My husband is not going to continue turning away from me like this. And she struggled like a lion to restore, to forgive, to rebuild. I don't know which of those is the hardest thing to do. And there are not many people like this woman, I don't think. You know, her strength, her determination, quite extraordinary. And her mercy towards her husband, it's not a sign of weakness. No, it came out of her strength and her jealousy. And as I said, I don't know her personally, but a friend who was sharing his admiration for her wrote a little article on Exodus. And these are the words that he wrote about God's jealousy. And I thought I'd like to share with you with them as we come to an end. Exodus confronts God's people with the jealous God who redeemed us, who expects our exclusive allegiance and fidelity, who wants us, mind, body, and spirit, who demands our undivided attention, who will not brook any rivals for his affection, and who in his tender-hearted compassion and loving kindness is committed to doing what it takes to maintain our relationship. That's the God whose heart we can try and look into this afternoon. His mercy, which expresses itself in that jealous love. And God's mercy is so surprising, so fundamental to his being, that these verses in Exodus that we've been looking at are actually quoted more often in the rest of the Bible than any other verse. It's the most quoted quote there is. With God, there's no mercy without judgment. There's no judgment without mercy. And yet mercy comes first, mercy comes last. In a while, I'm going to head you off to your groups, and I want you to think about the thing that I haven't thought about, because it's not in Exodus, and that is, how exactly is God going to manage to be the God of mercy without leaving sin unpunished? And that, of course, is the mystery that was revealed in the coming of Jesus. There's a really interesting allusion to Exodus 34 in John chapter 1, and that's what I want you to explore when we meet together about the revelation of God's glory. But I've gone on way longer than I need to, so let me finish with prayer. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable your judgments, your paths are beyond tracing out. Who has known your mind, Lord? Who has been your counselor? Who's ever given anything to you that you should repay? For from you and through you and for you are all things. To you be the glory forever. Amen.